join me in welcoming Danny Dorman. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the invite. I'm only going to speak for half an hour, so please think of questions to ask me as I'm speaking. I've never lived in poverty, and that's the most important thing to say. A large number of people in Britain, maybe about half the population of Britain, have never lived in poverty. The other half have, and about a quarter of people currently are in poverty in this city and nationally. What is poverty? There have been numerous arguments and debates over the years about what it means to be in poverty. The person, I think, who won those debates was Peter Townsend, who died a few years ago. But Townsend's definition of poverty, defined in 1979, is that individuals, families and groups can be said to be in poverty when they lack the resources to obtain the type of diet, participate in the activities and have the living conditions and amenities which are customary or at least widely encouraged and approved in the societies to which they belong. So to be in poverty is to be unable to have the means to be part of normal society, to take part in eating what other people think you should be able to eat, in doing what other people think you should be able to do, as a minimum. It affects people by the shame that poverty has. There will be people in this audience who will be poor. There are people who you meet in your everyday life who are poor that you will not know are poor. And then there will be other people where it is very obvious to you that they are poor. We have one of the highest rates of poverty in Western Europe at the moment. We often get used to it. We get a bit blasé to it. It was interesting coming in past the memorial at the cenotaph just now and watching the processions going there and the number of people who are going there almost 100 years on from when this began. Actually slightly less people there than there were at the demonstrations for the Syrian refugees held a few months ago in Oxford, which I thought was interesting. And of course, what got people in such numbers worrying about the fact we were not letting people in from Syria was people dying. More people have been dying in recent weeks in the Mediterranean than in the hottest months of the summer. And that is people fleeing war, but also fleeing the poverty that comes from being put in a refugee camp. The current message about poverty is absolutely stark. I wouldn't advise it, but you can find on the web a list of all those people who are thought to have died or have killed themselves in the last couple of years because they've been sanctioned for their benefits. Over 1 million people in 1 year were sanctioned for various minor infringements of the benefit rules, including not turning up for a meeting with their DWP official because they're actually attending a job interview to try to get off benefits. DWP, of course, refute the idea that anybody might have killed themselves because of any action DWP might have done. DWP refused to produce an estimate of the minimal number of people they think have died as a result of their actions in this country. I stopped watching the video when it got to the 22nd person, who was a young woman who threw herself off the balcony of a tower block clutching her toddler while pregnant. This is at the extreme what happens to people when they're excluded from being able to play a part in the norms of society, and when they live in a society which is so tolerant of poverty, so willing to have such a high amount of poverty as our society is compared to other affluent societies. Well, poverty rates are much, much lower in almost every other country in Western Europe. We have chosen and continue to choose to have the rates of poverty we have, and I'll give you some numbers later, but I think the emotion matters. I think the conclusion I have matters more than the facts I'm going to show you, and so I wanted to start with the conclusion. What made Peter Townsend come up with his definition of poverty? In 1958, Peter Townsend, as a young man, watched a man working on a fairground ride. And he got to think about fairground rides in 1958 and how they worked, if any of you were around in 1958. Think of St. Giles in 1958. He was making a roundabout turn using his own strength, and he was doing it for hours and hours and hours, pulling a roundabout with children on it. Peter watched as one young girl started to wail on the ride. The man retrieved her, and he was hurt in the process. He took a terrible blow in the middle of his back. The child's mother and father didn't thank him for retrieving her, but instead talked about how their daughter was especially sensitive. They didn't really see the man as human. They were rich. Their attitudes to others were a sign of what was later to become common in this country. Peter was particularly affected by that one incident. There may well for you have been particular things you saw, something you noticed when you were young, something that hit you when you suddenly realised what was actually going on. We get used to things. I was talking to my brother yesterday, and we were talking about the fact that a particular head teacher had had a shower installed in their office. And I was used to this kind of idea that you might have a shower installed in your office. My brother was absolutely shocked that somebody would take money that pays for schools and have a shower installed in their office. But I've got richer. I've entered a world in which these kinds of things are now normal. I was talking to my father yesterday about what I was going to say today. And he, of course, is much wiser than me, having a whole generation on top of me, and he's a bit calmer. And I was saying, this is so stupid. The situation we're currently in is so stupid. And what he said to me is, it's the system which is making people stupid. The amount of inequality we currently live in, the highest rate of inequality since at least the 1930s, probably since the 1920s, it separates people and it creates fear. It causes many of us to struggle to afford to pay for our children to go to some of the most expensive schools we can afford, or to try to afford to live in a catchment area of what we consider the best school to be, so we can aspire for our children. We give our children the impression that not to have achieved this would be a terrible fate, otherwise why are we bothering to do it? Our children are becoming isolated because they've got little understanding of other children's lives, because they do not mix with children out of the narrow band of the hierarchy they're in general. We positively discourage our children from having friends who might be a bad influence on them. We never think about other children's parents thinking the same about our children. Once we become more and more segregated, this city has become much more segregated than when I was growing up in it. We start to treat different groups of people almost as different species. We expect a large section of the population to be able to manage indefinitely on an amount of money for essentials for food and heating that most of us would find arduous to survive on for a week. We're so concerned about not losing status. That we think it is terribly important that we have much more than others. We deserve the amount of money we get, and there simply isn't enough to go around. We demonise large groups of the population. You see it on television. It's called poverty porn. TV will not do the same shows, such as Poverty Street, on Britain's greatest tax evaders. They won't do it. You could ask them to do it. This is a stupid situation we're in. It makes people ignorant. It makes people behave selfishly. It makes people callous. People are not naturally selfish or callous or stupid. But bring them up in the kind of society we're bringing them up in, and they're much more likely to become so. We have people arguing that you can't have a top tax rate above 50% because people wouldn't work if they were to lose 50% of their income. And at the same time, we have Ian Duncan Smith having an argument with George Osborne about whether they're going to take away 70, 80 or 90% of people's income at the bottom. They are not stupid. The system made those two ministers stupid and a bit callous and a bit ignorant. The views that we have that tolerate the rate of poverty we have are the product of our education systems and of our society. We live in a town in Oxford where there is a university where many people think that they are very clever, very special, and different from the stupid masses. And we have a particular responsibility at Oxford, higher than any other city has at the moment, because we have the highest rates of poverty in Western Europe. The poorest fifth of society in this country are living on the least, and it is getting worse. And our government, George Osborne, Oxford History, the Foreign Secretary Hammond, Oxford PPE, the Home Secretary Theresa May, Geography, my department, the Justice Secretary Gove, Oxford English, Paymaster Hancock, Oxford PPE, the Health Secretary Hunt, Oxford PPE, the Education Secretary Nicky Morgan, Oxford Law, the Environment Secretary Liz Truss, PPE, the Chief Whip, PPE, and the Prime Minister, PPE. You cannot ignore the responsibility of this particular town and its particular university to the reasons as to why we have such a high rate of poverty. And I'll give you some numbers soon because I will not go over half an hour. My father's story, like Peter Townsend's story, about what it was that helped form him's views, or he thinks it did. In the 1950s, my father grew up a very rich young man. In the 1950s, he was taken by his parents to see a young man who'd been paralysed from the neck down as a result of an accident. I don't know why his parents took him to see this young man, but they presumably thought it would be a good thing for him to see it. My father was shattered by the visit, but not by the young man. He was shattered by the place he was taken to. My father grew up in a wealthy part of Cheltenham. The place he was taken to was Ebor Vale. The young man's condition was the result of an accident, but the condition in which people in Ebor Vale were living in the 1950s was deliberate. It needn't have been like that in Ebor Vale. People were choosing for that to happen. Most people who we think have a social conscience have similar stories to this. Something suddenly made them realise that the world is not fair and that many things are happening now which are not just wrong, that need not have been. The sad thing is it currently takes these chance events to change our world view, the same as that toddler washed up on that beach over the summer, who died on the same day as the priest who'd been helping people for years and years survive on that island died. Surely our parenting, our education, our society, our religion should automatically tell us these things, but it fails to again and again. Some statistics for you, just some numbers. And there are so many numbers, I become immune to them. Households below average income is the statistics. They're produced every year and they tell us for various groups of children. Children we worry about most, but of course poverty stretches across the age group. They tell us what they don't have, which it is normal to have in society. Enough bedrooms for every child aged over 10 years not to have to share with somebody of the opposite sex. There are good reasons we don't want people sharing bedrooms with the people of the opposite sex. A quarter of children in the poorest households have to share their bedroom with somebody of the opposite sex once they've gone past puberty, and a quarter of the next fifth. Only 1% of the fourth most affluent quintile, and nobody in the top quintile shares a bedroom. Being able to celebrate a birthday at all in any way, about 5% of the poorest 40% of children cannot celebrate a birthday. Leisure equipment, think about having a bike. 1 in 7 of the poorest fifth cannot. Not a problem for the best off half. A week's holiday. If you want to know if you're poor, the simplest way to know it is if you have not been able to afford a holiday this year or the year before, other than going and staying with relatives, and you wanted that holiday, it's just a week away, and you cannot save £10 a month, then you're poor. That's the quickest definition we have at the moment. 60% of the worst off fifth of children in Britain had no holiday this year. Another 50% of the next off fifth. Essentially half our children in Britain are not getting a holiday. That doesn't mean that they don't say something happened when they go back to school in September and ask to write about their holiday. Children learn and know how to deal with shame and how to make things up. But these are the most dramatic. I can give you hobbies and leisures. Being able to have a friend round once a fortnight just for tea. Who cannot do that anymore? Being able to go on a school trip, not being able to afford the school trips. Organised activity, going to Scouts or Cubs, can they afford the Necco and the uniform? Having fresh fruit. Some things have got better. A warm winter coat. Only 3% can no longer get a coat. We don't have the absolute poverty as bad as we have it in the 30s, but the relative poverty is worse. People know they're poor. The government knows exactly how many children are poor and exactly where they are. In Oxford West and Abingdon, where we are now, it's 1,955. That's just under 10% of all children. If you're trying to find an area, this is a relatively affluent constituency, Oxford West and Abingdon. With Simon Stretzer, Professor of History at Cambridge, we produced a pairing of all parliamentary constituencies before the election, telling the MP where to go to find the opposite constituency to them if they want to see what life is like on the other side of the tracks. Not a single MP, of course, has taken our offer up. But the lovely MP for Oxford West and Abingdon needs to head off to Hackney North and Stoke Newington to see the mirror image constituency to here, where 30% of children are poor. Oxford East, 5,500 children, almost a quarter of all children in Oxford East are living in poverty. The government knows this because they are paying their parents benefits monies, which are not enough to get them out of poverty, but mean they do not starve. You know, this is 5,500 in Oxford East, and the paired constituency for Oxford East is High Peak, next to where I used to live in Sheffield. If you were trying to teach the MPs to see, I don't think Andrew Smith needs to be taught that much now, but if Andrew Smith wants to have a holiday, High Peak is where he should go. Oxford, quarter the population of the county, further all the jobs. She might think we're doing well, but it's not necessarily the good jobs. Poverty moves around Oxford. Oxford had slums in the 1930s, not far from here. I got a feeling I may have been conceived about 300 metres up there. I haven't actually asked my parents in great detail. What I do know is that although they were there, you, back in the 1960s, would not bring a child up there because there was a very poor area of Oxford and was a red light district. So they went up Market and uphill to Cowley, to a house next to Cowley Centre, which is now Templar Square, because that was posher in the 1960s, because there were jobs for all in the 1960s. Oxford was still building in the 70s. Oxford stopped building. Tiny extension to Blackbird Leeds in the 1990s. Nothing in the noughties. And this matters in Oxford, as I'm going to get to. And then we have a little bit of West Barton currently being built now. Traditionally, Oxford has tipped its poor up and out of the centre, over the hills, to Barton, to Rose Hill, to Florence Park, out of sight, but they can still come in on the buses and clean the colleges and the hospitals and so on. The most recent tipping up and out has been to tip up and out to Birmingham and to Gloucester, and to expect people to come in still from Birmingham and other places because we haven't built for them. There's Barton Park. There will be affordable housing on it. Only some that is actually affordable, a lot called affordable that won't be. It's just off the roundabout to London. You can guess what's going to happen to Barton Park fairly soon. Here's the 1927 plan for Oxford. The reason I'm showing you this is the rich and the affluent have squeezed the middle and the poor out of this city over time. That's what's happened. So if you're worried about poverty in Oxford, you've either got to make more space for people who've got less, or people who've got more have got to leave. And people who've got more, like me, don't really want to leave. I'd quite like to hang around for a bit now I've managed to get back. But I don't want to be living in a city of poverty, so you are going to acquire some building. The 1927 plan for Oxford was circular. because the main mode of transport in 1927 was bicycles. There were lots of other links between Oxford and poverty and attitude. An amazing number of children's authors were based in or near Oxford. Wind in the Willows wasn't actually about Oxford, though I do wonder, because he went to St. Edward's School, I think, just off the Woodstock Road. But this idea of the stoats and the weasels being constant trouble and you've got to keep them down, and there isn't much about them, but there are a few nice badgers who will be okay. It's in there. All the Narnia ideas. We're just up from the Eagle and Child pub, where C.S. Lewis apparently drank occasionally with Tolkien. Children going to boarding schools wearing ties and suits of armour, looking after animals who don't quite understand. It's insipid there in the kind of Oxford stories. Philip Pullman's Dark Materials are a nice change from this. There are other changes. Oxford's famous for its walls. This is one of the Cutterslow walls. This is an 8-foot high wall built about 2 miles north of here in the 1930s, with spikes sharp enough to kill a child put on the top to stop the working class children being able to get to school easily. That happened here. The walls were not taken down till the 1950s. That's how divided we were. We became much, much less divided. Somebody actually drew a tank through one of these walls. It was rebuilt, but they eventually got rid of them. We got to a point when I was growing up in Oxford when we no longer had grammar schools and secondary moderns, and nobody really knew what a good school and a bad school was. And they knew quite a lot of the private schools were a bit dodgy, actually, but I won't go into that. This is the 1970s, before you had every child from an independent school had to get AAA star. And Oxford was about as equal as it had got. The income differences were as low as they could have got. The quality of the housing was as high as it had ever got. So much of it had just been built by the 1970s. What we are seeing now, in exactly the same places as these walls are built, are the trustees of the academies who've taken over our schools setting rules for the schools of Oxford that say whether you can stay at that school at the age of 16, depending on whether you have enough GCSE results, and not telling the parents. So the secondary school nearest to that wall, if your child does not get 4 Bs and 4 Cs at the age of 16, they are out of that school. Far more effective than actually building a wall and putting spikes on it, but will affect people in the same place. TAME, it's not just Oxford out in Lord Williams, I think it's 5 Bs. Don't get 5 Bs, 16, get that bus into the FE college in Oxford, we're not for you. These divisions are starting again, and you know which children it's going to be. There's a nice policeman making sure that nobody interferes with the children walking through the wall in the past. It is possible again that we can reduce rates of poverty as we reduced them in this country in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s and 70s, and reduce barriers like that, but we have to recognise that the barriers are going up. The red areas are the areas with the highest rates of deprivation according to government. They occasionally make mistakes. That's a mistake. Christchurch doesn't have the same deprivation. There is some poverty here, there is homeless hostels, but it's also overcrowding of people in terrible situations, which is 14th century student accommodation. This is where my dad worked. He was a doctor. This is where we lived, and then I lived out here. Oxford's a very divided city, still is divided, or it's gentrified more over time. That's a picture from the 80s of me and my brothers. I'm the shy one at the back. All my other three brothers are far more able to do this kind of thing than I am. And you don't really need academics to tell you about these differences. School children in Oxford know about the differences between areas. The graffiti in Oxford tells you about the differences between areas. I've got about 3-4 more minutes, and then I will stop about it. I saw this map recently, and it really was taken by it. This is a map, and it fits, of course, with today. It's a map of who went to fight in the First World War and survived, which are the blue dots, and who went to fight and die. And it's the area just south of here, south of Carfax, Grand Point. So these are the blue dots of everybody who went and survived. The red dots are the ones who went and died. And if you look carefully, you'll see that the larger villas, people didn't go more often than the smaller ones. And you were more likely to die if you went from one of the smallest terraces back then. There were all kinds of connections between poverty and education and life chances and what happens to you later on in life. About five more maps and then please ask me some questions. Babies. Start off with babies. This is where the baby boom of Oxford is at the moment. This is where people are having babies. Because this is the only part that you can afford to live in if you're going to have a baby. The schools around here, the primary schools, they aren't actually full. I don't know if you've noticed. Very, very popular. People really want to get their kids into them, but they aren't full because people at the age of having children can't afford to live here. Let's disconnect from that and see what we're doing. So this is where the youngsters of Oxford are, and of course the bulk of the youngsters who are poor. This is apparently the site for the new free secondary school. If you were trying to pick somewhere further away from the children. But of course the schools which are oversubscribed, 1,800 children here, 1,400 children in the state school here, state school down here has spaces. Because of the divisions of Oxford, because of the poverty. Why does the state school down here have some of the very lowest GCSE results in the country? Is it something about the genes of the people who are there? The genes of the people who are there, are largely arrivals in the last two or three generations. The one defining characteristic of living down here is that you'll be living on very low incomes. And if you're trying to help your children get through secondary school on a very low income, say the minimum wage in Oxford, you can't afford to buy your child a second-hand computer. Second-hand computer is about £500. You need a second-hand computer to do your maths GCSE. You need to get a C in maths GCSE in Britain just to survive. How do you get £500 as a cleaner in Oxford to buy a computer for your child? Your college pays the living wage rather than the minimum wage. How long did it take Oxford academics to work this one out? 10 years from the beginning of the living wage campaign in Oxford. How many academics and experts did Oxford send down to Blackbird Leys to give them advice about how to educate better? Hundreds. Rather than simply pay the people who work in university enough money. I can get annoyed about it because it's annoying. And these are the differences in life expectancy. They're actually narrower than other cities. They're narrower because it's actually very hard to get into these areas now and survive. So we're losing lots of people. When somebody gets addicted to drugs, splits up, divorces, chucked out, loses their job and so on, they end up down in Hastings and down in Bournemouth or over in Gloucester, and they never get back. The children I went to school with here, hardly any of them are in the city anymore. They go out to Bicester, they go out to Wantage, they go to Grove, they go further, they can't get back in. The other reason the life expectancy difference is slightly lower than other cities is, my father is sure, is the consumption of alcohol in the colleges is enough to actually reduce it slightly in North Oxford. Cirrhosis is higher. Here's where the students are. They muck up the statistics. Students are a big part of our city now. A lot of them, maybe three quarters, are pretty affluent. But I really worry for what happens for the quarter of students who aren't from families with money when they're having to pay, £600 a month for a room in a terrible condition? I suspect there's a huge amount of hidden poverty amongst the university students. There's a lot of poverty amongst parents. There's even more amongst working age adults without children because they don't get the tax credits that the parents are about to lose. And there's pensioner poverty in Oxford. Age Concern Oxfordshire is very worried about the rise of poverty amongst the elderly. And of course we've got very rich elderly, which hides the fact that we have very poor elderly. Barton is gentrifying because it's near to London. You're seeing a tiny pocket of Rose Hill left as a concentration of poverty that I think will go in the next 10 years with gentrification. I suspect to see gentrification on Blackbird Lees soon. £320,000 for a free bed in Blackbird Lees with land on the edge to build on. And a nearby train, not a station yet, but it could become a station. And then what will happen? What happens when the areas that were poor end up gentrifying in the city? Here's the richest areas at the moment by social class 2011 census and occupation. That's an attempt to put all the social classes together to give you an idea of how the city currently works, this city of inequality. People claiming second home discount because it's their second house and their main one's in London. It's interesting. And I'll just put this last map up because I'm on time and the last map's a bit controversial, but if you're getting wound up before, this may get you even more wound up. We obviously need to do things nationally to reduce poverty. If we have one of the highest rates of poverty in Western Europe, part of the answer is obvious. You simply look to what else they do in the rest of Western Europe. What they do there is they tax people slightly more on their incomes, not much more, but a little bit more. Benefits are far more generous. For 2 years, you can be paid 80% of your salary if you lose your job, in many countries otherwise equivalent to us. You tax wealth at a much higher rate. We have the lowest property taxes in the world. £1,300 a year in London for a property worth £60 million. There's lots and lots of things you can do if you want to do it. We have to worry about the fact we don't want to do it. I can't give you really detailed numbers for Oxford because we haven't had a poverty report. The latest poverty report was done for London last week, and the stunning thing about the London poverty report is it showed that the number of children who were absolutely in poverty by their income, it's below 60% of the median household income, who were in private rented, had doubled in the last few years in London to more than 250,000. So in London, more children who are poor have got a landlord who is a private landlord than the council or housing association. This is likely to devastate in London, because what happens is they're having to move every 2 years, or faster, I'm told, because their landlords put the rent up and priced them out. If you're trying to absolutely destroy the education statistics of inner London, the fastest way to do it is this, moving children between schools. It's really rapid and very recent. I suspect the same thing's happening in Oxford. I can see the same thing happening in Oxford. When I tried to buy a house and managed to buy a house, and you almost feel guilty from the fact you can say you can buy a house, we looked in numerous houses in Oxford, and there was already a family in the house. Wasn't their house. They were the family renting the house that we might make homeless by buying the house from the owner of the house. But you don't have to worry, because that's going away, because now nobody can afford to buy a house. It's only investors and landlords. So people like me can't actually buy them. If you want to have a city without poverty in the future, you're going to have to make space for people. And if you're going to make space for people, this is one of the suggestions about where the space might be. You're going to have to bring them in different ways. You're going to have to bring them in with tram and light rail and so on. All of this may look mad to you, and it's not what we should be talking about. But I want to show where you go to when you start worrying about poverty in this kind of city, whether you want it to be a relic city like Windsor or an advanced city. You begin thinking, how can everybody fit in if we don't push some of the rich out, which is the other option. It's a bit like university expansion. We could have made university entry in the past fairer, by pushing a load of upper class and middle class children out and allowing more able children up. But that would have caused all kinds of upset. So what we did instead is let half all children in Britain go to university. Because it doesn't. Similar thing for Oxford. You could create a more equal Oxford in a very difficult way by expelling the people with money from this city, digging up the M40 so they can't get to London, so they actually have to move. Right? You know, you could do that. If you accept that you won't be allowed to dig up the M40, and we now have two train stations going to London. One just opened at Kidlington. Straight to Marylebone in 1 hour, direct. Do you know what's just beneath Marylebone Station? It's called Harley Street. Right? You can see what's going to happen. If you want this city not to be one of the most divided cities in the future, I think you're going to have to look at it being able to expand. But of course, what you do not want is Barratts building houses on the edge of it. Because if Barratts build houses, they build executive detached small houses with two car parking spaces. It's a complicated and it's an emotional issue, poverty in Oxford and Oxfordshire. It is very bad at the moment. It has been very bad in the past. The worst poverty 100 years ago was in the villages. No electricity, no gas, no heating. Likewise to Candleford. You go to the area where likewise to Candleford was written about now. It's off junction 9 of the M40. I couldn't buy there. Right. Things change. They change dramatically. I came back to Oxford 2 years ago. There are no buses in Cornmarket fighting each other anymore. Somebody had pedestrianised it. Somebody had put cycle lanes. Maybe not enough, but dramatic number. Things change in this city. It'll change again in the next 30 years. There is absolutely no need for this city to be a city with high rates of poverty in the future. There's no need for this city to be fossilised at its current strange size. The size that they thought was too small in 1927. But it won't happen without people saying it needs to happen, because we've educated so many people so badly that a significant group of people think that it's okay to have a quarter of their population living in poverty and there's nothing you can do about it. Thank you very much.
Jenny, for a fascinating talk and one that's got us all thinking. I'm sure there are lots of questions. I'd let you know that if people need to leave now, it's a good moment. But what we're going to do is take questions until 12 noon on the dot, and then we will wind down, okay? Everyone has their Sunday afternoons, including Danny. So, yes, Claire.
Yes, thank you very much for that, Professor Dorley. Alongside of the obvious need for a living wage for everybody, would rent controls help? Because there used to be rent controls, isn't there?
Yeah.
And does it have to be a government initiative, law, or can local authorities, could they put in place some sort of rent controls?
Okay. Yeah. The official living wage for Oxford is £8.25 now an hour. The City Council has a higher one, something that's slightly over £9 an hour, which the City Council pays. But it's not enough, because if your rent's going up all the time, it doesn't work. We brought in rent controls to get rid of slums, and it worked. And we also built state housing to get rid of slums. Somebody started teaching economists in the 1980s that rent controls create slums, and somebody didn't stop them being so stupid. So one problem is that all our economists, nobody did a PPE in that list I gave you, have been taught since the 1980s that rent controls stop markets working and create slums. It's so obviously wrong, but it's a problem to overcome. You can't do it locally, you can't bring in mild rent regulation locally, you're not allowed to do it. In fact, you cannot even prosecute landlords for renting stuff with rooms that are the size of cupboards. The High Court passed something last week saying that there isn't a uniform size for how landlords can behave, so they can charge as much as they like for something that you can barely fit in to sleep in. What you can do is use Newtown legislation like they used in Milton Keynes to, when you do build or add, not allow private landlords to ever own property. That happens in London with pocket homes. Boris Johnson supporting pocket homes. Pocket homes are sold at 80% of market value. You have to sell them at 80%, and you can do whatever you like with your pocket home, but you can't be a landlord. So there are ways of controlling things. But eventually we're going to need national government to do something about it. 3 and 5 year tenancies. The Labour Party have suggested 3 year tenancies. And in a 3 year tenancy, you can't put up the rent during the time of the tenancy, otherwise you can just evict people. Anyway, the best evidence of why we need rent regulation is that they have it. They even have it in the States, but they have it in most of the rest of Europe. We have the lowest quality property in Europe. So not allowing landlords to charge as much rent as they like has resulted in the worst quality, most expensive property. Somehow we've managed to teach economics so very, very badly for 30 years that economists are not taught why this has happened. They believe that if you let a free market occur, wonders will happen. And we've provided a nice example to the world of why that's wrong by actually running the experiment.
Thanks for a great presentation. I had a question about transport costs and poverty. I mean, just anecdotally, it's really clear to me in the nearly 20 years that I've been in Oxford that people on lower wages are increasingly working in outlying towns and commuting in.
Yeah.
And presumably transport costs are increasing as a proportion of their total spend, and that's having an impact on poverty. Is there data on that?
The data... We know that 40,000 people drive over the Greenbelt every day. The main cost is the petrol. The cars have actually got slightly cheaper. This is a second, third-hand car, but you can get data on the petrol, on the proportion of petrol, to see the rise. There haven't been enough studies done over time to see the shifting proportions of costs of people. A biggie was housing. Housing used to take 40 or 50% of people's incomes in the 1920s or 30s. The rent was so high. We managed to get the cost of housing down to around about 30% of your income on average. Less as you get older, more when you're younger. And now the cost of housing is heading back up to be 50% of incomes. And so if you can end up in the city as a teacher, you have no spare money after paying your rent, which then makes you want to live out, but then you have the cost of the petrol and finding the parking. This is why I put up the, you know, if you want teachers and you want them to be happy and you want them to get to age 26 and stay in your city, they don't want to drive from out here, they want to live in here, there's no space in here, so you've got to give them some space in here to live. And this is teachers. The precarity has spread way up society.
It's also struck me that the... it's not just the cost of transport, but the cost of quality of life of sitting in traffic for such a large chunk of your day, you know, and that is an inequality about what the amount of time you can in fact spend with your family.
The other option is to get people out of Oxford, get people with kids out. Don't try and run schools in Oxford. Just make it a nice museum, good tourist attraction, the elite university of the world and the odd hospital. I think you've got these two choices. You know, preserving a museum or making it a functional city.
Go ahead.
Listening to your talk, and it was absolutely fascinating, the first geography lecture I've attended for over 40 years. It was brilliant, and why did I lead it? But it's very, very difficult, personally, not to see yourself as the part of the problem much more than any part of the solution. So the odd bit of charitable giving makes absolutely no difference in relation compared to a couple who are living in a big house in Tame whose children have all taken the benefits of Lord Williams' school, then moving back into Oxford because we've got a daughter living here. So leaving a house that's quite big to sell it to most of the people. Well, we've only had two lots of people that come to look at, both of them are couples, so we're not solving a problem there. Only to try to move into Oxford where we might move into a house with 3 bedrooms and kick a family out.
Yeah.
And I suppose, so that's a very individual question, but how do you sort of square the circle individually when you're not necessarily particularly campaigning?
Any person, how do you do it? I think it's fine to give to charity and do all those kind of things, and definitely helps. The homelessness shelters help, the food banks help. It's just that they are ephemeral. You know, they'll always be there. They won't. And if you don't do more, they'll always be there. So when Joseph Rowntree said to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, he said it wasn't allowed to give money for soup kitchens. He wanted to stop there being soup kitchens. And we did. You know, they've come back recently. But I think it's fine. Just on time, on Oxford Radio this morning, when I was in the bath, they were talking about a project in Tame where they're going out to visit the graves of about 300-400 people who died in the First World War in Tame. Partly because almost no families who lived in Tame 100 years ago can still live in Tame. But the people doing this project kind of felt some affinity to do this. So I think although they're clearly not political campaigners, if you've got people who can be bothered to raise £23,000 to fly around the world to these graves, including in Libya and Iran, to visit the graves of people who died in Tame, you have got people with energy to do things. But it also shows how important politics is, I'm afraid. It is political. It doesn't matter how much money you give to charity. You know, if you carry on with members of parliament who don't see this as a problem, you either help those members of parliament see it as a problem or you get rid of them. And if you want an immediate get rid issue for Oxford, we have 6 constituencies in Oxfordshire, 5 producer Conservative MP, 1 producer Labour MP. If you could get the private renters of Oxford to register to vote by December, and the students to register to vote by December, we'll get 7 constituencies in the county. 7 constituencies gives you 2 Labour ones. I'm not a Labour Party member. I'd be happy with a Green or whatever. Apparently, if you say that, it's a terrible sin. But if you want to alter politics in this county, the most effective thing you can do is get people to register to vote before December. That gets you a whole new seat. It's far more effective than telling people how you think they should vote. I'm afraid that's the way our politics works in this country.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say something a bit about solutions. Until recently, I was the lead union negotiator in the John Radcliffe Hospital. And some of you may have remembered in the summer, there was a threat of a porters strike, where the porters were paid the lowest level of money anywhere in the NHS in the country. They were bringing in people who were actually on the minimum wage as well, and they were talking about cutting that. And the issue of poverty is actually explosive in the city, particularly when, if you want, low-paid workers organise themselves to fight back. And of the porters' leaders that they elected, we had 4 of them suspended at various stages by the hospital authorities. I am now facing gross misconduct charges from the hospital authorities. Really, it's so important that we go to workers and we say to workers, look, we will support you in standing up for yourself. And in a sense, it gets into this discussion about, you know, charity that people mentioned. And I agree, charity isn't the answer. I mean, just to give you a quick illustration, I remember speaking to an East Timorese worker who said, he was a cleaner, he said that he couldn't afford to rent anything. The best he could do with his family was to rent a landing in a house. So they're living on a landing
in Oxford, yeah.
This is the East Timorese worker.
Yeah.
Now this is hugely politically sensitive. The trust and actually any other employer hates the bad publicity. They brief the press very heavily against the union. So if you can do something, if you can speak up, but if you can make some of the employers locally feel bad about the situation that people hate so badly, I would
Thank you. Cheers. Yeah. This is sorry. Just so quickly, if Oxford colleges, some of whom are not as rich as others, can pay the living wage, the Radcliffe can pay the living wage. If it was well run, one thing worth saying is, paying living wage is a sign that your senior management are able. If they can't pay it, what else are they getting wrong in your institution? But the other thing just worth saying about the Radcliffe, the reason why I have these, and this isn't my plan, this is Nick Folkes's, long-term plan for Oxford. If you want to have one of Europe's most enormous, brilliant hospitals still running in the future, you need houses for porters so they're not living on the landing. And that's the place the houses can go, unless you want the porter to be driving. Or get rid of the Radcliffe and move it somewhere else. That's your choice for Oxford.
But property developers won't do it. It has to be planned.
It has to be, and this is outside the city boundaries, but it's a choice. If you want to run the Radcliffe Hospital without poverty, you're going to have homes.
A question right at the back.
Well, I'm just saying that you showed it's based on residential data, I guess.
Yes.
How are the homeless accounted for?
How are they homeless? Not particularly well, and they're rising dramatically. So the numbers are not well. Various surveys are done. I haven't actually heard of them done the last couple of years. But it's where you send people out and they go into multi-storey car parks and you have to find out where homeless people are. Homeless people have got better and better and better at hiding. So we can find them when they're begging, but not so good when they're hiding. There are people in tents living around the woods in Oxford now. And there are people on the banks of the rivers and the drains in those bovies that kind of hide you living down there. It's increasing rapidly.
Yes, right here. Thank you, Danny. Brilliant. And as always, and just to emphasise the political point, because we haven't seen anything yet, the next two things are the end of council housing, which the Labour Council here, I'm in the Labour Party, so is facing. The government wants to get rid of all council housing. And as well as the not-for-profit area of housing. But also, I'm part of Keep Our NHS Public, and there are rumours around charging for going to your GP. If you look at the family's income that you were talking about to start with, that is also going to put people in. But just to say, yes, getting another constituency is good, but also putting pressure on the Conservative MPs, because there are some who have reached their tipping point on some things. And it's really worth going to see Nicola Blackwood, going to see, get writing letters of that sort of thing to all those other people, John Howells and whatever, that are around the place. We've got to change it because we haven't seen anything yet in the way of the quality.
The other thing worth saying to that, it is, I may be too... you never know. I'd love to see Nicola, you know, change her mind in the future. But I'm going to give you a positive thing. Every Conservative MP voted against the minimum wage when it was brought in, every single one of them. Now, there are cunning reasons why he's done it. Not that cunning, because he's not a genius. But our Chancellor is introducing a much, much higher rate of minimum wage now. Okay, taking my crack sheets. It's possible that we're beginning to see the beginnings of a shift. And in 10 or 20 years' time, people will point back and say, it began with these things, and then that happened, that happened, and that happened. It's possible to be optimistic at the moment. Not just over that, the head of Barclays is paid much less than the head of Barclays used to be. The head of BBC is paid much, much less. Nobody's impressed by bankers making a lot of money anymore. You know, we have had quite a lot of change to our society already, but the length we have to go just to be like the Netherlands or Germany or France is a long way to go to behave like a normal, decent European country.
We have time for two more questions.
Thank you very much for a very thoughtful and welcome talk. I just want to say, having worked in Blackburn for many years, can I just say that one of the outstandingly positive things that have happened is that Andrew and Val Smith have lived in the centre of Blackburn, never moving, for 30 to 35 years. And I recently took my next door neighbours to the swimming pool there, and the swimming pool and the leisure centre, as well as the lives that the children are living, are so much better. They're not perfect, but they're so much better than they were a few years ago. There are still lots of improvements, but I think that Val as housing and Andrew as a very outspoken Blackburnley's resident, which has done an immense amount, which other people need to copy. And Blackburnley's is changing. There's less of a stigma for people living there, and their leisure centres and the environment they're living in is improving, but there's still an awful lot that we can do.
It's great. And the original building of houses was good. In retrospect, what was built was good. It's also the only place you can do street dance in Oxford. Not that's me. But these lines, this is a tram and light rail suggestion, connect Blackbird Leas. My big worry about what's going on, because it's what's happened to Barton, which is the estate I knew. Now, Barton is now where your senior researchers live. They move into Barton and then put their kids on a bus that goes all the way out of county because they've passed 12 plus and they can go to a state school in Berkshire rather than to the nearest, you know, schools in Barton. I worry about Blackbird Leas gentrifying. It may seem out of the blue, but Oxford tends to follow London, tend to be 2 years behind. You go forward 2 years and you'll suddenly see people going, that's a bargain. And you won't be able to live in Blackbird Leas then. You'll be living in the poverty street area of Birmingham and trying to find a way to get every morning from Birmingham into Oxford. That's my fear for Oxford. It's the tipping out one more tip.
Interestingly though, there are Blackbird Leas families who are trying desperately to move to Rose Hill. So it isn't just about people moving out, they're trying, they realise, some families feel, and we still look down on them, and there's a stigma attached, and they're moving to Rose Hill, not many, but quite a few.
Yeah, and then they can go to Spires.
And Rose Hill is...
It's gone up.
Market.
Yeah, it's very different from the city I grew up in. And lots of changes are good, but the schools need sort. That's another. You're looking at £100,000 house price difference between each of the five secondary schools, because the fear is so high between them. And the idea that this city cannot sort out its education is again another part of the problem. This city tolerates poverty. Last question.
One more question, but I'm afraid we have actually reached the witching hour, and I did promise to stop at 12. So, I mean, I know Danny has a website. There's a lot more you can learn. He has many publications as well, a lot more you can learn about his stuff, and we will put a summary of the talk on our website, so please take a look at that. Sign our list if you want to find out about more events. But above all, a huge thanks to Danny Rowling.